I think our next session is on the conceptual framework, and I will hand over to John.
Right, good morning everybody. Yep, next section is on the exposure draft of proposed amendments to the conceptual framework, which the ISB published in May and is asking for comments around the end of November. As you'll be aware, the conceptual framework covers a range of different aspects of financial reporting, and at your last meeting you discussed the chapters on measurement and on presentation of income and expenses, which was primarily about which income and expenses should be reported as part of profit or loss and which should be reported outside profit or loss in other comprehensive income. And this time we're going to move on and discuss some other chapters, specifically to discuss the chapters on the definitions of assets and liabilities, the concepts for recognition and derecognition of assets and liabilities, and some of the additional concepts to support the liability definitions. And we're going to start with the definitions of assets and liabilities. And if you turn to page 3 of Agenda Paper 3, under paragraph 7, we've got a table setting out the proposed new definitions, which have a definition of an asset as a present economic resource controlled by the entity as a result of past events, liability, a present obligation of the entity to transfer an economic resource as a result of past events, and a new definition of an economic resource, which defines an economic resource as a right that has the potential to produce economic benefits. And this new definition of an economic resource as a right is really just confirming a shift away from traditional notions of accounting for physical objects to notions of accounting for the rights and obligations embodied in these objects. The main change, really, apart from that, is the removal of the word expected from the definitions. And that's really intended to clarify the definitions, because some people read the word expected economic benefits as implying that something couldn't meet the definition of an asset or a liability unless the probability of inflows or outflows exceeded a particular minimum threshold. And that was never intended, and it's not how the ISB has interpreted the definitions in recent standards. And then the question on page 4 for you, really, it's what our discussion is: do you agree with these proposed definitions, or do you have any comments or questions on them?
Kevin?
I know we're talking in the conceptual framework, but I naturally link in to current accounting standards. So when we get to an economic resource, totally on page, a right that has the potential to produce economic benefits. If I think in the mining industry, because we have an interim standard called IFRS 6 that's nearly 15 years old.
Name not recorded has joined the conference.
I'm compelled under IFRS 6 to expense exploration expenditure, but I definitely have an economic resource which you then tell me that because under a standard I'm compelled not to value, I'm not allowed to recognise. But I think we're starting to duplicate the same word, whereas we recognise an economic resource, we then measure it and then elect whether to report it, as opposed to you can't recognise the economic resource, measure it and then elect whether to recognise it. I've recognised the existence of the economic resource first. And using the word recognition to mean an asset or liability that's included in the financial statements means that every immaterial asset is not recognised. Well, it is recognised. It's just not reported.
It's identified. It's certainly identified, but it's the way we use the terminology, yeah. Recognition. It's possibly the use of the term recognition to mean a specific thing, whereas you might see it as meaning something else.
Well, I think, I think it appeared in the South African comment letter. Defining the word in your own meaning without reference to the Oxford English and the Merriam-Webster doesn't change the general definition of the word and leads to misinterpretation. That's what I think, our recommendation back was that when you get to putting things into the statement of financial position, that's reporting, it's not recognition. Otherwise, when you then in the future go to IAS 8 and you want to amend as to whether I've got a prior period error, if I've recognised and measured and there's some inaccuracy in the measure, I might have a change in estimate and not an error. But if I have if I've identified, measured and failed to recognise, then I could very easily end up with a error and not a change in estimate. And I think, you know, it's that process that needs to be clearer in the standard, because, you know, like in IFRS 6, where I am compelled to measure an asset at zero, I definitely have got an asset. I've got an economic resource. I have something I can sell to somebody for future value. You can't tell me I haven't recognised it. I've just not reported it.
Okay, not so clear. So your question is about definition of recognition?
Yes.
It's about the relation between expense and asset.
No, it's the definition of recognition. I think recognition is when you recognize the existence of an asset or a liability. If you subsequently measure that at zero, then it's reported at zero. It's not recognized. It's a reported at zero. It was always recognized because you needed to identify whether you had an asset or liability first.
I think this the concept of for several decades.
It's terminology.
Yeah, it's terminology. Used for decades, you know. Yeah. Recognition means, you know, recognize into financial statements in number and some, you know, term used for.
But in the
decades.
Conceptual framework, you're also using the word recognition. Jonah said, we mean identification. But in the conceptual framework, you're also using recognition in order to identify the existence of an asset or a liability. So you've used the word recognition in two separate areas to mean different things.
I don't think
we tried not to.
Yeah. No, we certainly tried not to. I mean, what we tried to do in there is to talk about the existence of an asset or liability, which is what the definitions are trying to identify. And we then say, well, if you have an asset or liability that exists, you then go on to think about whether you want to recognise that in the financial statement. So we did try to draw a clear distinction between that. And I think Weguo makes a very good point that actually recognition, the term recognition has been used for a very long time in accounting to mean recognition in the financial statement. So we talk about recognition criteria, for example.
But when you apply the concept...
I'm sorry, Murillo, do you are on the phone now? Murillo? We have somebody on the phone.
That is Murillo, yeah.
Hi, Murillo. Can you do us a favor and put your phone on mute? Because we have some noises.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Name not recorded. Has left.
I think the debate is whether you can recognise an asset at a value that ultimately becomes immaterial for the consolidated financial statement. Whether that lack of appearance in the financial statements means it's never been recognised. Well, it actually has been, but the materiality override meant that it didn't appear.
And I also don't agree, because that is maybe to recognize in the internal bookkeeping system, but recognition in our terms is, as Weguo said, it is in the financial statements. And even if you have somebody, some transaction recognized in your internal bookkeeping system, but then you decided based on materiality consideration not to include it in the financial statements.
Yeah.
That
but
is not, then it is not recognised in the financial statements. And
but then, say, but with IFRS 6, you end up with a compulsory derecognition of everything that would pass the test of an asset or a economic resource, but is compulsorily derecognised. You've got a clash in there somewhere that you can have a standard that literally now overrides 100% of the conceptual framework. Because you've got a standard that compels me to measure at zero.
Okay, my understanding is like this. Recognition the definition is defined such a way. But for a particular item, whether by the end you will recognize, measure, and present in financial statements will be a result of different judgment areas, either by the company or based on the standards. You know, I don't think you know the definition recognition of recognition itself will result will create such a problem.
Generally, I'd agree with you. I just see where it impacts our industry, that we end up with items that will meet the definition of an asset, that will meet the definition of economic resources, and then fade into the ether. And is that correct in terms of trying to present information that's useful and relevant to investors?
Yeah, it is correct. For example, up to now, you know, the standards say that you should not recognize that internally generated wealth. Some will say, no, there are resources, and they will create future benefits. But the standards, you know, apply different principles in relation to measurement, recognition, all together, and say you should not recognize. You know.
I mean, we acknowledge in the conceptual framework that there can exist assets and liabilities that we then subsequently decide we won't recognise, and journal come on to the sort of recognition criteria that we propose in the exposure draft later on in this meeting. But the idea of the recognition criteria is to say, well, if recognition is not going to provide particularly useful information to users of financial statements, then we will decide not to recognise things, even though they meet the definitions of assets and liabilities.
Okay, there one clarification. This is a very interesting question, conceptually especially. Based on our new proposed definition of recognition, and you are suggesting we need to consider some delicate issue like, the measured amount becomes immaterial. So maybe under the current existing definition of recognition, one of three criteria, there is a reliable, measurable criterion exist in the recognition criteria by definition. But in the case of a proposed new definition of recognition, there is no such reliable, measurable criterion anymore. So, but still we have some kind of if there's a low probability or some kind of measurement uncertainty, then we shouldn't recognize such kind of any item. But the structure of definition of recognition are a little different from these two existing ones and the new proposed ones. So you are suggesting maybe your issue might be more related to new proposed definition of right.
Yes.
So that's
the
why you are suggesting.
The old one, it's the new
yeah.
one. Yeah.
That's very interesting case. Conceptually very interesting. Maybe you might think more carefully about this kind of a situation under the new proposed definition recognition.
I find that it is very difficult to answer the question you asked in the paper, if we agree with the new definition. Why I say that? Because to measure, the difficulty is to measure the consequence of this change in the definition, the application that can be done in the future, or should be done in the existing standards. Suppose that these standards have changed. So it would have been useful to appreciate changes that have been introduced, to have an illustration of the consequence a change may have in a standard and in practice. Just to illustrate what I want to state, for example, economic compulsion, constructive obligation are concept or notion that are taken into consideration to take the decision to have a liability and to register that liability. My question would be, the proposed changes for this new definition involve how these changes have an impact on what is in IS 37, recognizing the use of this concept, constructive obligation and economic compulsion. I do not see what consequence I have to draw from the change in the definition, and it's very important to say if I agree with the new definition or not.
I think that the changes or possible changes to IS 37 don't stem from the changes in the definitions themselves, but from some of the supporting guidance, which we're going to come on and talk about later. It's the last topic in this session. But these changes are stemming not from the changes in the definitions, which personally I see mainly as clarifications of the existing definitions rather than as changes that will have significant implications on what does or doesn't meet a definition. It's hopefully just going to be clearer why some things meet or don't meet the definitions.
Okay.
I think picking up perhaps on Yo's point, that it strikes me that at times when we're in a business combination, we actually look for more assets and liabilities than we do when we're not in a business combination situation. Do you see any challenge in that? I mean, we obviously are forced to recognize, goes into a bit internally generated intangibles or intangibles in general. So we look for those in a business combination situation, but we don't look for them in-house if we're doing them in-house. Do you see a conflict there?
My understanding is business combination standards is purely based on fair value. Therefore, you have to recognize everything based on fair value. But when the standards define principles on particular asset, it may not apply for value notion at all. Therefore, the difference is great. My understanding is from this angle. Peter, do you think I'm right?
Yeah, can I add a couple of things to that? I don't see there's any great contradiction, because the board would need to take recognition decisions at the standards level. And I think it's perfectly understandable that it would reach different conclusions in a business combination or transaction of any kind than it would for an internally generated intangible asset. Because for a transaction, you have to account for the transaction. There are two sides of the transaction. You've got consideration, you've got the things you're receiving. And we've tried to put a lot more emphasis as well in the exposure draft on the fact that we're not just accounting for the balance sheet, but we're accounting for the transactions and the other side of the entry. And so I think it's not surprising that those decisions about what's going to be relevant information and also the cost-benefit considerations are not necessarily going to end up in the same place for a business combination as they would for internally generated intangibles. The other thing I wanted to remind you of is that in the follow-up to the post-implementation review on IFRS 3, one of the questions we're looking at again is which intangibles we recognise in a business combination. So it may well be the board might think about reassessing whether it's drawn the line in the right place at the moment. But again, I think that the point would still be the assets exist. The question is a recognition decision. Do we think it's appropriate to recognise those assets in that particular situation?
Kevin?
That's just for a point of clarification, because we aren't going to cover measurement in what's going on here. But when I read the definition, I accept the standards can do what they're going to do. But is there a natural link that my measurement of a liability is totally dependent on how I've measured the asset that I'm giving up, because it's the transfer of that economic resource? that so there's a net if because the an asset is a present economic resource, mm-hmm. and an economic resource is the right to potential, and the liability is the obligation to transfer an economic resource. If my liability is naturally measured at the same value that I'm recognising the attendant asset, and that is a bit of a misnomer to me as well, because you know, again, in the mining industry, I can give up future cash flows that are not yet recognised. So my shareholders have lost value, but I'm apparently not saying anybody about it.
I don't think there is intended to be any implication in the definitions that the measurement of a liability would reflect the measurement of the asset that you would be transferring, the economic resource that you would be transferring.
So I have an asset at one measurement value and a liability at another measurement value, but I'm giving up that asset.
The
you can see why I get a bit confused.
That could be at a different measure, because it could be at the value of the proceeds that you're expecting to receive for it. So that would be if you, you know, if you had a piece of inventory, and
I'd write it down to NRV. I wouldn't write it up.
A sale. You wouldn't write it up necessarily, no. But you would be, and that would be because you would be measuring your obligation at the proceeds you've got to receive. So they wouldn't necessarily match. But I think that's how we do things at the moment. It's not implying any change or any implications for measurement.
I think if I've got an obligation to deliver inventory at a set value and that value is lower than my carry value of inventory, I've got an NRV problem.
Yeah.
So I see that a natural link, and I'm sort of...
You could have all sorts of natural links or not links sort of things, but I think the main point is that in the definitions themselves aren't implying
anything in
link.
Measurement.
But then we try to emphasise in the recognition section and in the measurement section that those linkages may be pertinent when you're deciding what's going to be the most relevant information. And so the board would think about that when it's making the recognition decisions and deciding what measurement basis to use.
Euro?
I basically agree with the current proposed definitions, which is much straightforward. And I'd like to ask one question regarding the definition of economic resource. And you currently propose using the word right. And considering the economic resource or the factor of asset includes the asset like goodwill or intellectual property or know-how or various things. So I'm wondering whether this right definition can cover all sorts of things, because I tend to consider that right is very related to the legal situation or something like that. So I want some more clarification how why you use this word, right?
It is used quite broadly, I think, in the exposure draft, and there is some guidance as to what it would cover and why. I'm not sure exactly why that exact scope was.
We did start out with the discussion paper, and with the discussion paper we talked about rights and other sources of value to sort of try and capture that broader population of things that I think you're talking about. But there was quite a lot of confusion about what we meant by the term other sources of value. So what we did for the purposes of the exposure draft was took out that term other sources of value and then tried to explain in discussion around what we meant by the term right, that when we talk about rights, we're actually talking about quite a broad population of items. It's not just restricted, for example, to legal rights or to property rights. It is a broader spectrum of things.
And actually, when we decided not to include that other sources of value idea, it was because we rediscovered some words that are in the existing framework that we thought actually covered that situation. So we picked those words up and updated them a bit.
Olivia?
I have late memories about discussion we had on the taxes, asset and liabilities. Peter, remember that. I would like to know if the new definition will have impact on the recognition of deferred tax assets and liabilities.
I don't think it would have necessarily an implication for what meets the definition of whether a tax asset meets the definition of an asset or a tax liability meets the definition of a liability. I think both would fit within the proposed definitions in similar ways to which they fitted within the existing definitions.
Remember that we at that time, years ago, we wonder if tax asset and deferred tax asset and deferred tax liabilities meets the definition of the framework of today.
Yeah.
So I'm not it's whole memories,
yeah.
But
yeah.
I would like to know if it will be a problem in the future for you to accept the recognition of deferred tax assets and deferred tax liabilities as they are today, because I believe that the role of deferred tax is to match the P&L before tax and the tax, which is a really good idea.
I mean, personally, I think they meet the existing and the proposed definitions. I think where you could have a debate is about whether they are always separate assets and liabilities, or whether they're part of the measurement of the underlying assets and liabilities, which is perhaps a more kind of unity of account question. But it's clearly a feature that exists and affects your financial position, not just it's not just a kind of matching thing, I think.
And I think in some ways the new definitions would make it easier to justify why they're assets and liabilities, because it emphasises that they needn't be unconditional, and the point is, do you have rights that mean that if there are economic benefits flowing, they flow to you or from you? So if anything, I think they help to justify why they are assets and liabilities.
Yeah, and I think you can see them as a bit like options in a way, that if you operate the business and recover the carrying amount of the underlying assets, then this would be the tax consequence of paying it. So it's a bit like the payoff on an option in a way.
Martin,
yeah.
Your question, your suggestion, to understand what you are trying to suggest to us is we need to reintroduce other source of value in addition to the rights, or you just ask us to clarify what a right means. So, you know, it seems not clear what you are suggesting.
Because the English is foreign language.
Yeah.
So, firstly, I wanted to have more clarification what right will cover in the scope of various assets. If similar question raised in somewhere, then I would suggest that in somewhere, what is the coverage or scope when you use this word right? That is just my
suggestion. You might guess maybe some existing assets might not be covered by just a concept of right. Is it right?
Yeah, in my first instinct, right, the word right is not relevant to present, for example, goodwill is,
yes.
In my interpretation,
right.
Goodwill is not necessarily right. So, mm-hmm. so that is why.
That's why Peter has just explained to you. For that goodwill, we in the DP we have a kind of a more broad concept, right, and other source of value. However, we removed other value of source. So, but we are suggesting putting back that phrase other value of source to cover goodwill. That's what you are suggesting.
Or to clarify what
just to clarify,
just to clarify. Yeah,
it covers really this kind of value.
Okay.
Hiroshi?
My comment is related to your question. And reading the paragraph 4.8 of the exposure draft, there is no comment regarding the goodwill or know-how. So if you are thinking the right is in a broad sense, you should clarify that wording has a in a broad sense, including goodwill or know-how.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for that. So as we have clarified what assets and liabilities are, we come to recognition.
We've sort of already touched on recognition, which we've defined as meaning including in the statements of financial position or performance. And the exposure draft is proposing that a sort of different approach for setting recognition criteria in standards. At the moment, the existing conceptual framework, if you look at paragraph 14 of the paper, it basically says that the same three criteria should apply in all cases for all types of asset and liabilities. And there's sort of problems with all three of the criteria to some extent. The first one is that the item must meet the definition of an asset or a liability, but the conceptual framework doesn't go on to talk at all about what to do if existence is uncertain, which it could be in cases like litigation. The second one, the second criteria requires probable future inflows or outflows, which is appropriate for some types of asset and liabilities. We've got it in IAS 37 and it's regarded as appropriate in there, but it is not necessarily appropriate for all. So in some standards there isn't a probability criterion, it wouldn't apply, for example, to derivatives. And then the last criterion is that the asset or liability has a cost or value that can be measured reliably, and that's a reasonable concept, but the terminology is slightly out of date. Reliability isn't the terminology we use for the qualitative characteristics. So the exposure draft is proposing a different approach, and it first of all makes the obvious point that failure to recognise assets and liabilities makes financial statements less complete and can exclude useful information. But it then goes on to acknowledge that recognition of some items doesn't provide useful information, and by useful information that would mean information that's not relevant, or it doesn't provide a faithful representation, or it would provide recognition would not provide benefits that exceed the costs. And the result would be that recognition requirements would vary between standards, and so the ISB would have to think about the recognition criteria whenever it's developing a new standard. In paragraph 16, set out some of the discussion in the conceptual framework about the factors that may affect whether recognition would provide relevant information, and these are very much the same sort of factors that underpin the existing recognition criteria. But the exposure draft stresses that the presence of any one factor wouldn't necessarily stop the recognition of a particular asset or liability. It's often a combination of factors that means that recognition wouldn't provide sufficiently useful information to justify the costs. And this new approach, I should say, isn't it designed to either increase or decrease the range of assets that are or are not recognised. It's just designed to provide the board with us a more coherent set of concepts and a process to apply in deciding whether to require recognition of a particular asset and liability.
there's a slight difference in emphasis in the exposure draft from that that was in the discussion paper. It tries to take a very even-handed approach, avoiding any suggestion of a presumption towards recognition or not recognition. And it doesn't propose that only the IASB can make decisions about recognition. So if there were a particular asset or liability that wasn't within the scope of a particular standard, it would be for the preparer to apply the concepts to judge whether that asset or liability should be recognised. We have discussed recognition a little bit. I was just wondering if there's any further comments on the recognition criterion, whether you agree with the approach being proposed.
Rashi?
I don't support this new approach. And among Japanese consultants, there is a lot of concern for the change of recognition criteria. Because your proposal, which is in paragraph 15, so relevance and faithful representation and cost benefit. All of them are very ambiguous, and these three criteria are quite similar to the element in the chapter 2, mm-hmm. Very similar qualitative characteristics. And in addition, and in paragraph 16, you show the condition of relevance, that there is only low probability and have a level of measurement uncertainty that will lower the threshold of recognition significantly to lower threshold. So as you commented that some program of recognizing derivatives, I think that should be an exception. So if you change your recognition criteria, the IAS 37 provision will be affected. So I prefer existing conceptual framework, probability criteria, and reliability criteria is very important.
So are you suggesting that you would keep the criteria and then in individual standards, if necessary, depart from the conceptual framework where it was necessary? You would keep all the criteria, but for some exceptions, you would have some exceptions.
Yeah, but that's one way of thinking.
Yep.
Yeah. Another way of thinking is if you have problem on the derivatives, if you consider derivatives as a whole, that could meet the recognition criteria.
As a portfolio.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. The question is, if you suggest to bring back the reliability and probability threshold, what's the conceptual load,
mm-hmm.
For you? Can you say suddenly in this chapter, the recognition threshold is probable and the reliability, because we propose to remove reliability concept at all from the quality chapter.
Mm-hmm.
How can you suddenly bring back?
I can catch your question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now we in the 2010 ED.
Mm-hmm.
Reliability concept already removed from quality chapter.
Yeah.
The question is, how can you bring back to the recognition chapter as a threshold, as a criteria?
My question is, if you remove from reliability criteria from this, reliability criteria will disappear from the conceptual framework. In my view, reliability is a very important factor for recognizing asset and liabilities.
Maybe he also not agreeing with this, what is on chapter 2, that the reliability criteria is also removed from the...
Yeah, I know.
Sandra?
In paragraph 16, it may be easier for people to understand if you switch those around to positive factors instead of negative factors. And looking at the middle one, I wasn't sure what was meant by low probability? You know, what threshold is that, and how do you?
it is, you're right. It's not defined.
Right.
There is a discussion of low probability, but I think that the idea was to leave scope for deciding what would be the right threshold in, for different types of transaction. And last time we talked to you about IS 37, in which you fairly uniformly decided that 50%, which it is at the moment, was probably about right, but it might not be about right in other cases.
But that's definition of probable. This is low probability, which, and if your conceptual framework is meant to help provide guidance in the absence of other standards, then low probability, having no definition, doesn't help any
has left the conference.
Help anyone. So,
I was just going to say it's not intended though as a rigid threshold. It's intended as an indicator. So if you think the probability is low, undefined, then you would start thinking about whether that information is going to be relevant. And there are other factors you consider in deciding whether it's relevant, but these are kind of warning flags that you might need to be thinking about it a bit more. But it's not really intended as a threshold. Now, the board might decide to put a threshold in the recognition criteria in an individual standard, because it, you know, concludes that that's the most appropriate approach in that standard. But this is giving the board the thought process for going through, for thinking about that, or for the preparer if there's no standard.
And I really think, when we are here on the conceptual framework level, and when I was also, when we first discussed it, concerned about that, especially regard of IS 37, does it mean, okay, that we now have to recognize on a lower threshold we kind of legal cases and whatever. But I really was convinced, because when we're discussing derivatives, and I think what Hiroshi also said, maybe I think it is not good to have a conceptual framework which will then not cover really recognition of derivatives. When you have an out-of-the-money option, which is level 3, it is not reliable. There is not probability, and the probability that you have some outflows or inflows is very, very low, so not recognizing it. That would be really the consequence. And to start in a framework then from a with the consequence of a big portion, which is financial instruments, not recognized, I think is not a good starting point. Therefore, I think we have to change that, but clearly it could be consequences. Mind, there is currently not any intent. And I think that is then a decision which we have to take with me discussing IAS 37 on a standard level. And my personal view is we should not change, but okay, that is then a board decision. But clearly there is this kind of risk and chances, and I think that is what we are discussing here, is if we said, okay, our framework is not currently covering a big portion of what we have standards for, which is financial instruments, and therefore we have to do something, I think. But clearly there is, I understand that people think there is a risk, okay, that maybe that has implications also for other standards, which we, I think, don't have the intention now, but can we exclude it? No, we can't. Olivia?
I was not at the last meeting, but I read the news about the discussion, and I want to say that I agree with the reaction of other GPF members on the AIS 37 future new proposal, I would say, which I understand will better fit with the proposal of this framework and this definition and the criteria for recognition. So, personally, I do not agree with the fact that better information will be an average percentage of situations that, in fact, are a theoretical estimation that we could have about litigation, for example, because, in fact, it's today very difficult to have a response, simple response of is it probable future outflows that we have to recognize, and then we can estimate it. And if we have to tomorrow to make several assumptions with percentage of realization, I think it will never be realizable, because when you ask to a jurist never have 10% of change of having that amount, 30% of change of having that amount, and so on. This is not a real life, let's say.
Well, I agree to that, but I also, when I came from an industry where I think there would be information about the level of risk which they have from litigation, would be, I think, even a little bit earlier in the financial statement, would also be helpful, I think.
But it, giving information about the risk is something, making a overall estimation of amount is something else.
I understand, but if you have some risk, and that is then the question, is okay, how, if there is a probability of only 25%, is it risk, should be reflected already in the statements or not, or in the disclosure? But that is a, I think, a discussion of a future project, which we have to do then. Malcolm.
I mean, I think many of us are struggling to really understand at the standard level what the implications may be of these changes. And I think especially when we think of IAS 37, at least my reading is if we don't have this probability threshold, that perhaps because, you know, especially if you're in a situation where there's a binary outcome, either you win a case or you don't win the case, but if you lose a case, it could be $100 million. If you win, it could be zero. Putting $50 million as the average of the outcomes perhaps is not useful. So my reading of this is that this would allow us, if I read this right, to carry on with disclosures and actually of the situation, but not be forced to recognize any point figure because it's not relevant. I mean, is that one of the possible outcomes that when one reviews IAS 37 in the light of this, you would actually no longer be forced to recognize or record in your financials a stupid figure, because you know in that particular case of 100 or 0, 50 is never going to be the right amount. So it's not relevant information, you could argue.
What this approach is saying is that the ISB, when it was developing or reviewing any standard like IAS 37, is that it would apply these concepts. It would think what's relevant, what's a faithful representation, and think about all of that in the context of the transactions within the scope of the particular standard, which in IAS 37 case would be things like litigation. And it would say how probable is it appropriate to have a probability threshold in this particular case? And in IS, so it's not saying, it's not forcing the ISB to either remove it or include it. It's saying what's going to give the best information. And in particular, when it's considering what is the most relevant information, that puts some onus on it to consult investors and other users of financial information. And one of the things that I thought was quite interesting from your last joint meeting with the CMAC was that there was a fairly uniform view that for transactions within the scope of IAS 37, that 50% threshold was about right. Some was about right, and it was the users of financial statements as well as the preparers that felt reasonably happy that for the purposes of measuring and putting a point number in the financial statements, that was about right. But that, of course, a lot more disclosure was also used.
I actually would disagree that certainly my view of what we said in June was that actually by being forced to put a figure in the financials actually prejudices you. And I would actually plead for focusing on disclosures, but rather than being forced to come up with some sort of statistical calculation, which is never going to be the right answer. So I'd plead that in the case of a sort of a win-lose situation,
Nothing
should be recorded because it can't be measured reliably.
And until what point?
Well, that's I would say until you've got the outcome and you've got the judge coming down from high with his ruling. So I think you're opening up here. You know, I can read that into it. Other people might read something else into what you're proposing here. I think as a preparer, I'd welcome being allowed to defer recognition until I know finally the outcome, because it's only when the judge has deliberated that you actually are sure what you've got enough certainty, or you put a table, or you've started to enter negotiations or whatever. So is that
right?
I'll let Kevin go first.
Yeah. No, I'm where Malcolm was. I thought we concluded in joint with the CMAC when we said the 50%, that 50% was the more likely than not of losing, not
yep.
the mathematical calculation of a number that was improbable of ever existing.
That's right.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. Because as preparers, if you're in a litigation situation, even if you think you're going to win, you'll still make a judgment call that if they come and offer a settlement and that amount is going to be less than your future legal costs, you'll still pay.
Yep.
That doesn't mean that because I'm always in that mindset that I've now got a minimum liability, because they might never come.
No.
And they might also withdraw the legal action for whatever reason. So even the future legal costs I'm never going to estimate. So it's like we need to be in that position to provide the contingent liability type disclosures rather than, well, this and this and, you know. So when Michael was going on about risk is what the shareholders have got. They know that. For me to start including their perception of risk in measurement of my liabilities is just inane if I've got multiple shareholders and potential investors to consider.
No, I get that point.
Right.
This is one area in listening to, you know, Sandra, Olivier's, your comments, Malcolm, and Kevin, that I think has a very, very strong connection to our work on disclosure. I'm in complete agreement, you may be surprised to know, with both you and Malcolm here in this area. I don't think investors are served very well from booking a point estimate. That something is extremely uncertain. But Sandra, I think, actually, we always tend to focus on liabilities here, but let's just think about assets for a minute. If you go back 40, 50 years ago and you think about some of the know-how that was being developed in the Silicon Valley area in the 1960s that ultimately spawned half a dozen to a dozen companies that are household names today in the technology industry, you know, did an asset exist? Well, there's no question an asset existed in my mind, but would it in fact result in economic benefits, would flow, you know, from that know-how? Highly uncertain, right? So would an investor want to know about these types of technologies, you know, things that, for example, Exxon might be doing in the energy field, or things that might be going on in the pharmaceutical industry? I think there's no question. So for my mind, I think if there's too much focus on recognition and measurement around these issues, and then, you know, they're just kind of put to the side, and we don't really address how you're going to serve the interests of investors, i.e. through disclosures, I think we're gonna throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. This, in my mind, is really a big frontier for financial reporting. And it not only covers some of the basic things, but a lot of things that you're hearing that are front page news these days about environmental, social, and governmental issues, I think are connected to this. How you create value, you know, for your employees, how you create value for the environment, or how you're destroying value, you know, in any of those situations. Avoiding costs as a way of creating value in the future. I think these are all related to whether or not assets and liabilities exist today, you know, the size of them. And I think it's critical that there be some discussion around this in the notes of the financial statements. So, and I don't think the conceptual framework is going to go there. And I think that's going to be a hole in the framework, to be quite honest with you, unless you see it otherwise, you challenge that assertion. But if this is only focused on recognition and measurement criteria and not disclosures of this kind of information, I think This is where you, I think, speed to market relevance of financial statements will be increased if information around these kinds of things, assets and liabilities, are done in a balanced and fair way, as opposed to you got to learn about it, you know, through other third party or other types of research that you might conduct on a company, on an industry. So just a view, you know, from where I sit as a former credit analyst, and I was thinking about, you know, where is this company creating value, where is it destroying value, and, you know, what information do I get from the four corners of the financial statements as opposed to other places that I'm talking about. To me, this is an opportunity for management to communicate, as opposed to just it being the compliance exercise that, you know, we talk about that balance.
We do try in the conceptual framework exposure draft, when we talk about presentation and disclosure, to try and get across this idea that that the financial statements should be a communication exercise, and we talk about the importance of disclosures in terms of putting across that sort of communication to the users of financial statements. I think with the conceptual framework, though, we're obviously stuck at quite a high level there, and getting down into the detail about how you actually achieve that, I think probably sits more at a standards level, and in particular disclosure initiative type thing.
When I understand what you're saying and what others are saying, but I don't really agree to that in overall, because if you have a detailed analysis from a user or financial statements of a specific company, maybe yes, it's true. But for me, it is always relevant that financial statements that are summarized financial information, where people draw debt ratios, leverage ratios, whatever, and don't have all this detailed information and come to certain conclusions. And it's therefore, I think it is relevant if something is recognized or not. And I think disclosure is for me not always a kind of substitute for recognition and measurement, because there is another objective also for me in financial statements, which is summarized financial information, which makes for many users maybe easy to compare companies and not to go to 500 pages of disclosure. Maybe certain analysts are doing that, which are experts, but there is only a portion of users for me, and therefore I think that has to be discussed. Okay, is it relevant information if you have to recognize, and disclosure is not always for me a substitute for that. But having said that, Kevin.
So I'll disagree with you and support Pat. Everyone's been concentrating on the consequences on IAS 37. So I'll get on my hobby horse, the consequences for IFRS 6. If I've spent, or my organization has spent, $700 million in Colombia developing a 30 million ounce resource of gold, copper and molybdenum. $700 million is expensed in the income statement over the last 8 years. The 30 million ounces of gold, copper and molybdenum are lying in my reserves and resources report. Your concept of, is there any uncertainty that I've got an asset or liability? Absolutely zero. Okay? Is there a low probability that I'll get inflow? I can sell it tomorrow to competitors, or I can choose to develop it myself. Can I measure it? Probably not with any reliability. Should I be telling someone within the financial statements that there's this non-recognized asset of certain value that the shareholders and potential investors need to be? Yes, they shouldn't have to go somewhere else. It is a real asset. So the concept of using a derecognition accounting standard but adopt it with disclosure makes perfect sense to me. And maybe just unique to our industry. You've probably got similar types of unrecognized assets resources.
We have all our reserve disclosures that supplement our financial statements, and don't feel that it's in our best interest to quantify them, where the users are going to be the ones that apply their own models to value what they think our future resources are worth. So.
And would you agree that, for example, financial institutions should not recognize any level 3 derivative and only disclosing, because that is your concept?
I'm not saying it's the concept. I'm saying when the accounting standard, as in IFRS 6, says you do not recognize, then there's a disclosure consequence where the standard overrides the principle of what constitutes an asset. So when there's a derecognition accounting standard for an identified and measurable.
But I understood you saying, okay, the problem which your case was, it is difficult to measure, and therefore it is not recognized, and therefore, okay, this
but
problem
I
makes
can't,
sense.
I'm not saying it's difficult to measure. I know what it's cost me, the 700 million, and I could apply an IAS 36 impairment model to, if that was necessary, to get to a value. If the standard as it sits under IFRS 6 says if you're in the expense model, you stay, well then I've got an override in the standard, so I should have a disclosure requirement to provide that relevant information.
But
because
I
there's
feel,
a standard
you know,
override.
I don't think you're you know, contradicting each other.
No.
You try to say in the case of banks, you know, the standard should require to recognize such things. It's okay, even though it's a low probability. But in some other cases, you know, standard setters decide after consider all of the factors not recognized. But the, you know, in reality, current standards require so, and maybe in the future we should also continue to do so. In some cases, provide additional information will be useful to the users.
Yep.
I think I don't think it's contradictory from two sides.
For me, it is the difference is if it is part of your really normal business, like a bank dealing with derivatives, you should be able to measure that and should be recognized. If it is a legal case, it is different things. It is exceptional situations, binary outcome, maybe you don't have the methods, then I can discuss it that way. If you are in the mining industry and doing some investments and whatever, or in intellectual capital in Silicon Valley, you should be able to measure that. And then it should be recognized. That is, for me, the distinct factor. Because otherwise, maybe you don't understand your business if
yeah.
you can't measure it.
But I'm on that page. But at the moment, there is a standard that bans recognition.
Right. yeah. But I think really, and but that is coming back to the framework.
Mm.
I think the framework is in line, at least what I have said, because I think this should not be really a kind of distinguishing factor if it is reliable measurement or not. It is for me not. In some situations, maybe, in others, not. It depends on the situation and then on the standard what you're dealing with.
Mark? I mean, from my point of view, from my reading of it, and it might be my reading of it is different to the board member's reading of what you're proposing. I actually quite like what you're proposing here, but I think that's one of the areas where we are perhaps grappling. I mean, you certainly mentioned that if this conceptual framework was adopted, it would change levies. I think that's about the only example you've given concretely of where there would be a change. Perhaps I'm incorrect there. I know that the board perhaps doesn't want to preempt future discussions standard by standard, but there is this little bit of a challenge for us reading it. We don't quite know where the board sees the implications of what's being proposed here, and I think we certainly many of us as preparers focus on the liability side because that's the area at the moment. Certainly, me and I'm sure many of my colleagues as preparers, you know, we spend a disproportionate amount of time at the end of the year when we prepare our financial statements, actually having discussions. audit committee level and with our regulators and auditors about whether or not liability should be recognized. There's less of a discussion about assets, although of course we have to recognize that we're moving increasingly into a world where, you know, it's IP and intellectual assets that are there and or softer assets. But so is there no way that the board could set out a little bit more than just levies, could say, well, you know, if this conceptual framework is adopted, we anticipate, subject to standard level reviews, we anticipate that this and this area would have to change. Just so we know what's in your mind a little bit.
I think our target is to finalize this. Yeah. We would have that discussion. I think we will maybe another annex story.
One of the big problems that we have with actually doing that sort of analysis, and we know that people really want that sort of analysis of, you know, this is what's going to happen to these particular standards if we do that, is that a lot of what we set out is actually about the thought process and the judgment process that the board would have to go through in setting standards. And it's quite actually difficult to second guess what the board's sort of judgments and analysis would be on particular standards. So, for example, on the recognition criteria, we have the recognition requirements in existing standard. We know that we're changing the recognition criteria, but the recognition criteria are quite judgmental, and I think rightly so, because it gives the board the ability to think about, you know, particular circumstances like the mining, like litigation, etc., in a particular way. But actually then sort of saying, well, what judgment would the board come to in this particular situation, I think becomes quite difficult for us to do.
No, I don't think it would be fair to preempt the detailed discussion, but you could certainly, I think, give a bit more flesh around which thorny areas you think these changes could, you know, give you directions on.
Look at the other side. If the whole world, different people have different willingness,
yes,
then how can we, you know, the board, you know, say we want to do this, regardless, how do you think? It might be very dangerous, you know.
But we tried to give a signal by saying explicitly that the board would go into the exercise with the objective of either increasing or decreasing the amount of special economic. So, of course, it might reach different situations in a different answer in different, you know, in particular situations. But its overall objective wasn't to get more things on balance sheet or more things off balance sheet. So that, and I think that's as far as the board could really go without actually getting into the individual issues. And we can't get into the individual issues without knowing enough about the individual issues to know where we go. I mean, we can have a discussion around the board table, but it wouldn't be based on full knowledge. So
there was a paper, and I know it's also in the discussion paper, of a list of scenarios and the various kind of criteria that Joan has laid out in this paper and how the outcomes might be interpreted. They weren't absolutely conclusive, but I think directionally they give you a sense. So, to your question, Malcolm, about how this might apply, you know, the classic example we debated for many, many years was, is a variable lease payment a liability? You know, we had various views on that depending on which of these three outcomes in the discussion paper that you chose. So it might be worthwhile, I don't know, for the GPF to go back and take a look at those before you finalize your views on the subject, but I think that might be helpful to your analysis.
Right.
No, sorry, Martin. May I?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
There's a question from Australia, too.
Go ahead, Peter, maybe.
Okay, Frank, you first.
Thank you. Can you hear me well?
Yeah.
I want to take the conversation a little bit forward. I hear things about coherence, faithful representation, and allowing the board the judgment in the future to make decisions when they face problematic issues. The issue I want to raise is the asymmetry between derecognition and recognition. I noticed that in paragraphs 531 and 532 for derecognition, the board has given themselves two paths forward with derecognition. That is, to either allow it to happen or not allow it to happen and get a gross up on your balance sheet. Why don't you introduce something similar when you come to executory contract to allow the consideration of whether you gross up for the underlying asset and obligation or whether you recognize it net, which is what the current proposal is? And the reason I raise this is because, coming to your comment earlier about leverage, there's a lot of hidden leverage today on the balance sheet because of gross settled derivatives. And at least if you open up the conversation in the conceptual framework, at least in the future, you can come back to whether or not the gross up versus net or a gross settled derivative is one or the other a better presentation?
Yep.
Okay. Thanks for that.
Okay, I should comment on the Sandra's. You suggested some problem with the low in a low probability.
Right.
So there, in the first criteria, if you see that there is a is uncertain, if you see that the final one, then a high level of uncertainty. So already there are three different expressions on that. The degree of uncertainty. So, you know, maybe I'm sorry to ask you, do you have any kind of suggestions to improve this kind of expressions?
I don't have a suggestion now. I'd have to sit and think about it. But, you know, just reading through it and having gone from a probable criteria previously to now something that's low probability. Yeah, it really made me question where is the cutoff and how do I take this and apply to something that perhaps maybe doesn't have standard setting already done for it and go through and do the evaluation.
Yes, absolutely. This is a quite tricky issue. So for your information, I have heard
the small number of remaining conferences, this conference will be broken down in 40 minutes.
There will be a kind of a summary report to investigate all kind of expressions on this kind of likelihood uncertainty in our IFRSs by the Australian Accounting Standard Board and Korean Accounting Standard Board in this December for the ASAP meeting. So basically they found out more than 30 different expressions on the degree of likelihood. So very, very confusing. Yeah. And in English, you know, the meaning of the literal English meaning is very difficult. And also in translating these different terminologies into the foreign languages, that's more difficult. So they will help us to make maybe the reduce the number of expressions, maybe from 32, maybe more than 30 to maybe 10 or maybe 5. So I'm saying that we are considering this issue is very serious, and especially among preparers and maybe others too. So please follow that discussion in December. That will help you a lot, I guess.
Okay, very good.
Okay.
Hey, Sandra, are your supplemental disclosures or reserves, are they audited or are they unaudited?
No, they're specifically referenced to be unaudited. Mostly because the auditors don't have the technical...
I understand, but you don't either on litigation rely on a lawyer to say it's probable or remote. Could this... And the same could be true on reserves, but I'm just asking, didn't remember what it was.
Yeah, they're unaudited.
Okay. Which becomes a bit stupid. Because they might the SMOGs aren't audited, but those same unaudited numbers are used for the depreciation model.
Yeah. there's a level of review, but yeah, the technical assessments of the reserves,
yeah,
you know, that auditors just wouldn't be able to opine on that. They have to rely on internal management's assessment.
Okay, Jack, go ahead.
We have two more topics in this paper and just over 10 minutes to discuss them. So I won't spend too much time introducing either of them. The first one is derecognition on page 8. Derecognition is the decision to remove an asset or a liability from the statement of financial position, which is obviously quite easy to know when it should be removed in many cases. It's when it's been settled or expired or sold or something. But the difficulties can arise in particular if assets are transferred to another party, but in some sort of partial manner, so that not all the rights and obligations embodied in the asset are transferred at the same time. And we've had different approaches and different standards. And one's been a sort of control approach, you derecognize when you transfer control. Another one is based on risks and rewards, so when most of the risks and rewards transfer, you transfer. And what the exposure draft is proposing is that It's not saying that one or other should be done in all circumstances, but it's setting out, in, as I've set out in paragraph 24, a sort of summary of what's proposed. And the gist of it is that in deciding, making decisions about derecognition, the ISB should consider both the assets and liabilities retained after the transaction and the change in the assets and liabilities resulting from the transaction and how to faithfully represent both of them. And it goes on to say that normally this would be achieved by derecognizing the rights and obligations that have been transferred and continuing to recognize those that haven't been transferred. And that in most cases that would achieve both of the aims of derecognition. But in some circumstances, that approach might not achieve both aims. For example, if the retained component has a disproportionate exposure to risk and rewards, or if the transfer is subject to some sort of repurchase agreement. And so what the exposure draft is proposing in these situations is that if it's difficult to achieve both aims, the first thing to consider would be to enhance the disclosures around the retained components. And if that's not enough, then you consider an approach where you don't derecognize the transferred component but continue to recognize it without any income or expense. But that's the sort of final step. When you can't achieve a faithful representation in any other way, that's what you would do.
Okay, Hiroshi?
I think the approach of exposure draft is very complex and difficult to understand. I understand there is a complex case, but your judgment is based on the explanatory disclosure. If disclosure is adequate, you say that you should recognize. If disclosure is not adequate, you should keep recognition. I think it's very strange. It's uncomfortable with this treatment. And I prefer the approach of discussion paper in a control approach, and risk and reward approach is much comfortable. If it's the case of control approach, as a whole, it's very good. If you recognize part of the asset and liabilities, I think the risk and reward approach will work.
I think it might appear more complex than I think it would actually be in practice, because the gist of it is that you derecognize assets, the rights you've transferred, continue to recognize the rights you don't, sorry, that you haven't transferred, and it's only if that looks like it feels like it's not giving a faithful representation of the changes in the entity's rights and obligations that you consider, well, how do I rectify this problem that we're not giving a faithful representation of the changes? And the first thing will be to consider is, if I give good disclosure, is that going to be enough? And then if not, is should I adopt a more sort of risks and rewards approach?
In my view, the disclosure is not relevant in judging the recognition.
Okay.
Kevin?
I think what you're trying to solve here is a unit of account question, because if you have an asset which has got multiple components of both risk and reward and retain, if you can carve up and componentize the asset into what you've got and what you're giving up, then it shouldn't be an issue, because if you are retaining more risk, it's a component you've retained. I think your problem is, can you measure that if you're going to make an election of an apportionment of carryover historical cost, or are you going to make an election of, because you've lost control of the whole thing but retained 100% control of a reversal risk? If you've got a control test environment, are you going to go to fair value because you've lost control? Therefore, the risk and reward might be an easier methodology to calculate a number than to try and do a fair value method, where if I've sold a land or sold a parcel of debt with a right of reversing back the bad debts, well, then I'm back into this IFRS 9. What is my probability of the debt returning to me? It is quite high, so maybe I've sold nothing. When you actually have sold something, but it might be difficult to identify what if you can't componentize correctly, which is again back to your, how do you value your unit of account? Is what's the debt, what's the future income flow, what's the risk of return, what's the cost?
Could I raise one other point to this discussion that is in this paper that Joan's prepared, and that deals with the definition of assets and liabilities. If in fact an asset, all assets, whether they're financial assets or non-financial assets, are defined as some total of your rights, okay, in a given set of resources that are going to provide benefits. So even a car is nothing more than a package of rights. Everything can be reduced to a package of rights. I'll park another consequence of that conclusion over here, which is that in theory every asset is intangible, even a car. But setting that aside, okay, then the question arises, how do you apply a risk and rewards approach to that? It really, I think, argues very much towards a control approach. Do you control the right or you do not control the right? You know, to essentially arrive at the same approach as to whether or not you recognize an asset. Do you use the same approach in reverse to derecognize an asset or a liability? So in my mind, that has significant appeal. Where it breaks down is in the fact that we have a mixed measurement approach for assets and liabilities. So in some cases, if everything's measured at fair value, then the changes in assets and liabilities occur irrespective of whether or not you're recognizing or derecognizing assets and liabilities. In a mixed measurement approach, when you have amortized costs, though, you have changes in assets and liabilities being recognized as a result of derecognition events, which is not necessarily very helpful to the understanding of the economics of a business, because it then puts into the hands, as Gerard said earlier, the ability and the intent, right, to derive how income gains, losses are recognized, which is not necessarily, I think, an objective way to measure performance. But it's a consequence of the mixed measurement model. And this is obviously a debate I've had around the board table on many, many occasions. So control really works very nicely with the notion that assets and liabilities are packages of rights or you know, requirements, obligations to transfer rights. And not as well, I think, with risk and reward, but therein lies the moral hazard of going down that path, because for amortized cost type assets, it raises the specter of that age-old problem of gain on sale accounting, which we all know, you know, at least in the financial services industry, was not very helpful. In the non-financial services industries, it hasn't been as thorny, but it certainly, again, it doesn't contribute to, I think, high quality of earnings when you can kind of gain the recognition of gains and losses.
Kevin, I wasn't sure where you were going because you seem to be pushing a risks and rewards approach some of the time, but then you seem to be talking about componentization, which seems to focus more on what's been retained versus what's been transferred. So I wasn't quite sure where you thought.
I think it's a matter of what is it. Are we on Pat's page that if I have talk as a bank, I have the risk of the debt going bad, and I've got the reward of all the future income flow? Is that what I've done when I've partly sold off something, or have I actually handed over everything and simultaneously issued a guarantee contract? Now, if I'm in that page, well, then I've given up all the risk and reward of the underlying asset, and I've entered into a separate new contract, even though it was inherent within what I had already. And then I can be in a risk and reward. But if I'm, no, you already had it, well, then you're in the control. And I'd prefer to be in the, I've sold you everything. It's a reversionary right. That's a separate thing. And I'll account for the separate thing
even though I always had the reversionary right in the asset already.
We have two comments, and that's also another topic which I think will keep us away from lunch. So before we're doing that, I think Olivia was first and then Mark.
A quick thing that I have in mind. I have quite a difficulty with control versus risk and rewards. For example, when we sell a car and when we will buy it 3 years later, in fact, during the 3 years, I have no more control on the car. But I have a residual risk on the value of on the residual value of the car, because I will pay at a price, and maybe the value of that car 3 years later will go down, for example, or will go up, but we never know. So I understand that I have a risk, but I'm not sure I have the control. So I agree, I'm not against the way we account it today in financial statement, but we could also have registered a one-shot sale and less value to pay back, instead of recognizing an asset that we keep at the balance sheet and that we amortize, and having a lease contract during 3 years. So in that case, I have difficulty to understand, if I refer to control, the principle we apply today.
Sorry, Martin, I wasn't not wanting to stop the discussion, but I just wanted to actually make some closing comments, so perhaps we, but by all means, cover the other points. I mean, I think first of all, I welcome the fact that you've managed to get this conceptual framework out, that you've covered all chapters in the conceptual framework. I know that you've been traveling around Europe and the world, I guess, with outreach activities. So, I mean, this is a challenging topic. I see that you've given yourself even 6 months after getting the comment letters in, even to work out what your timelines are for implementing this. So are we, perhaps concretely, are we going to, is it going to be, a year or 2 years before we actually get this finalized? Any sort of stab in the ground? And perhaps secondly, as a result of, I know it's preliminary because you haven't got all the comment letters in, but which are you finding this conceptual framework resonating pretty well with as part of the outreach? And which are the areas which you are detecting and hearing pushback on? So perhaps just, if I may just broaden the debate a little bit to
yeah, of course.
Sorts of points.
In terms of timetable, we obviously the comment letter deadline was extended by 1 month. Which means that it closes on the 26th of November, so I would encourage everybody to get in comment letters on that. We are hoping to bring comment letter analysis to the board probably in March of next year, with a view to actually finalising and issuing a finalised conceptual framework in early 2017. So we're still talking about a fairly aggressive timetable on this project. You're quite right, we've been talking to lots of people during the comment period and getting their feedback on it. I think that there is a general sort of welcome for the conceptual framework and the ideas in that. There are some areas that keep cropping up as areas of concern, and I think it is largely around things like the approach to OCI, profit and loss and OCI, and asking for more guidance around that. There are some concerns that perhaps the measurement chapter doesn't provide sufficient guidance to the board about selection of a measurement basis. The areas around that we've been talking about today in terms of definition and definitions of the elements and recognition, those seem to be generating much less debate than perhaps the other things. I think more of an acceptance that perhaps they're heading in the right direction. And we're also inevitably hearing quite a lot about the issues around stewardship, prudence, reliability. Although I think quite a lot of people are welcoming the changes that we've actually proposed in respect of those items in the conceptual framework. Anything else obvious that I've missed, Peter or Joan?
Does doing away with the probability threshold, is that generally welcomed or?
We do hear some people saying actually we would like the probability threshold back, but to be honest, that in my experience, and this is purely my impressions from the outreach we've done, that most of the people I've spoken to are relatively relaxed about that and perhaps acknowledge that all we're really doing is reflecting the way in which the board has been thinking about these things for quite a long time. But as I said, that's my personal opinion from outreach rather than a scientific analysis of all the letters that we've got.
Okay, thanks for that, Rachel. I think we have the last point. I think it was really kind of the present obligation, our concept. And we don't have to, everybody has read the paper, but is there any concerns, comments from the group regarding on that? Is your levy?
Well, you mentioned the levy change. That's the only thing you've really concretely mentioned is going to change.
So you're happy with it, right? Seems not the case.